Stanley Fall, Reel 6.
Yes, well, what my father, when he said, and we had the family meeting, he said that we are not going to move east as the Newton-Rath asked us to do. We're going to stay here and survive that terrible period because the war is going to finish very shortly. Now that America is in the war and Britain is on our side, we are going to destroy this man. And our job is to wait out and survive that period of time. Now, this stuck in my mind at all times. I said, look, we're going through a difficult period, but that's going to end, and there won't be normality, my father said. And he was the only person I looked up to. And what my father said, this must be right. This is the way I was brought up. So therefore, it was an inbuilt thing. Well, I've got to survive, because Dad said so. You see, it is an abnormal time. That time will pass. And of course, it should have passed as far as I was concerned last week. I didn't know when it's going to pass. Nobody told me it's going to take so many weeks or so many years. So I feel that, I now feel that somebody used to look over me, direct me, call it what you may, in order to make sure that I was on a certain path to survive. And I feel it to this day, that there is another being there looking over me. Why I was chosen, I don't know, but I was. And the result is I'm still getting on for 70 years old, and I'm still here.
You went through an awful lot, didn't you? You know, the ghetto experience, and then Majdanek, and then Skodzisko, and then on to Buchenwald and Theresienstadt. You must have seen some awful things, Stanley.
I have seen some terrible things, and I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but when I first met my brother when we arrived in England, and he asked me for the very first time, he says, now tell me exactly what happened since I've seen you last. And I chronologically started telling him what happened to when I said goodbye to him. And I remember my mother crying at the railway station when he left in 1937, that's 2 years before the war broke out. And what happened to me and to my sister and to my family during the 2 years, and what happened when the war started, and how the ghetto began, and how most of my family were left with many tens of thousands of people to go east. They were directed to go to the extermination camps, which we now found, I then knew. And how I lost contact with my father, how I lost contact with my sister, how I lost contact with my... And I started telling him chronologically. It took us about 2 hours. His commanding officer was present, and he walked off, and Gerald and I discussed it. And then, after telling him three-quarters of the way through, when I've seen my mother and what I have seen, the horrors, the disease, the shooting, the barbaric treatment of human beings by the guards, to an extent that I felt that this is normality. And I could see, there's my brother, a man in uniform, as a soldier to me, elder brother, cried hysterically. And I vowed that there and then that I will not discuss this with anybody, because if I can upset my own brother to an extent as I have done, and he was uncontrollably emotionally upset to such an extent that I said, I will never repeat that or discuss it. And I dismissed it from my mind at that time because I felt that if I can upset my own brother, what would I do to normal people? And it was unfair because unless you've gone through that period yourself and discussed it with people who were there at the time with you, and I even found it most recently, we can only discuss these terrible things amongst ourselves because they're not believable by normal people because it is inhuman. It is the barbaric actions of the guards and who were, as I say, not most of them were not Germans, were so barbaric and so sadistic that it is unbelievable. And I have, for many years, even until my own children were old enough and they asked questions, and I said, read about them, then ask me, and I'll tell you. Because it is incomprehensible to an intelligent person to believe that it happened. Even now, I sometimes think it must have been a dream. Because how a nation like Germany could, who is an educated, much more than what I think of the Poles, as it were, who are a civilized nation, to get into that sort of a condition to destroy a race of people, doesn't matter, they're Gypsies, Jews, cripples, of their own people, their own political prisoners, to exterminate them as a matter of law, that to me, even to this day, is incomprehensible. But it happened. I've seen it happening. And this is something which, this is why I feel that the Holocaust Educational Trust, which is being formed in London, is a very, very important issue in order to educate not only the British people, but to educate the world to make sure that this doesn't happen again. It is something which means you've got to try and educate the children to see, to show them it happened. It is not unlikely to happen again. It can happen to, if there's a problem about race, it doesn't matter, yellow, black, white, and race, once you've taken religion or race into consideration, and you've got a wing, a political wing, say, well, they're no good, and we're better than they are, then there's a danger this will happen again. So it is important to deal with the young people of the world, to educate them, to make sure they have respect against their human beings. This is my opinion.
Your liberation, you know, you were saying how ill you were and the Red Cross came. Would that have been after liberation? When you were saying how the German guards disappeared and then the Red Cross came. Would that have been at the time of liberation?
Yeah, that was with the Russian, during the time that was late April, when the Russian administration came in, with them the civil administration came in, and the Red Cross came in with them. And that was the first food parcels, food which was not just bread, but there were sardines, and there were very beautiful pre-packed food, including milk, powdered milk. But they were upsetting. We were not ready for it. You see, what we should have had is dietitians to make sure that we can, that our stomachs now could stand that sort of food. We weren't used to that type of food, and a lot of our number died because of it, because they were overeating, upset the constitution, and they couldn't stand it. And I was nearly one of them. And I remember clearly, to me, it happened with sardines. And to this day, I don't touch sardines.
How did you feel, though, you know, this feeling at last it was liberation? Were you well enough to feel any reaction?
When the liberation took place, I only wanted to go back and see my brother, because I knew at the time that I was no good going back to Warsaw, because I could see it when I left in ashes, as it were, and I knew that the family weren't there because they were exterminated. The only person I was hoping that my sister, and being older than myself, would also know that my brother's in England, and she would, so we would communicate. This is fortunately, when I arrived here, I found that I wanted to get away from Europe. And for many, many years, I wasn't able to even think of Europe, because Europe, especially Poland, was to me like a cemetery, where my nearest and dearest were lying dead. And to me, thinking of Poland was always, and some of my peers don't agree with me, because Ben Helfgott, one of them, begged of me, my own friend, my own children wanted me to go back, because they wanted to know where I came from, where I was, where my roots were. But I can't get myself to go back there, because my memories of Warsaw after war, they were very happy before the war, but after the war, with the loss of my family and my immediate family, and without any help by the Poles during 1943 onwards, and is, to my mind, not forgivable. So I sooner keep away, because I feel that with the Poles, and they need to be educated, and I think that what is happening now is, if one looks at the map, as I said before, if you look at the maps, the Poles virtually encouraged the various camps. Because if you look at the map of the camps, the extermination camps, none of them are in Germany or in France or in Czechoslovakia. They were all in Poland. If you look at the map, Poland and eastern, the eastern side of Poland, bordering Russia. Because I don't think that the French, the Dutch, the Italians would permit this on their soil. And to this day, I feel that this is where I put part of the blame onto the Poles. I don't say they're all bad, but there was an element of help they gave the Germans over and above the duty. And that is, for me, again, unforgivable. And while my peers said to me, please come back, let's go back to the various camps, let's go and have a holiday there, see what my own family wanted, my sons wanted to go, particularly my sons, to see where I was, what happened, and to see it firsthand. But I can't get myself to the city to get back. I'll go anywhere else, but not to the continent. I'll go to France, to Italy, but not to Poland.
Did you receive compensation for what your family had lost in Poland, in Warsaw?
No. The reason for that is, when we have got representatives through the 45 clubs, and of course, the German compensation is I was given a lump sum because I left. But fortunately, I was healthy. Some of my number who are unhealthy, either physically or mentally, are getting pensions. But you see, I was taken into school. Well, shall I continue?
Yes, I wanted to ask you quite a lot about that. But was there anything else you wanted to say about your, you know, that was the end of it, was it? You know, that the Germans just gave you a lump sum?
No, exactly.
You had
no.
nothing in from Poland no. in terms of property.
No. Because the Polish government have nothing, even to this day. When they turned from communist into a republic, they have got no monies to give. The problem is, while the Germans were a wealthy country after the war, and they said, we'll pay compensation, there were two reasons. As I say, would I have been unhealthy, I could have got a pension. But I elected for a lump sum, which was a very nominal sum, some £500, I believe, in those days, because I was healthy. And secondly, would I have not been healthy when I was working for my firm, for my family firm in England, I took out insurance, and the first thing they ask you, what's your state of health? When I had, for pension purposes, etc., British pension purposes, I went through medicals and I was chosen as A1, so my premiums were low. But I can't say that I was unhealthy for the German authorities, so I took a lump sum, and I am fortunately touch wood, I've been healthy ever since.
Long may you remain so. But if I could go on to the boys now, you know, you were saying how in Treason there was a group of 350 girls. Did you know anything about the organisation of this, the way you were coming to Britain?
Not that. I was told that we're going to go to England and you've got to go and report anybody who's passed the medical. And had to report to a certain area, and we were taken to Prague, and we stayed in a hostel type until the bombers arrived, and we didn't know what they were. We packed in. I mean, they were bombers. They weren't passenger planes. And we were set, like we always used to, one next to each other. There were about probably 50, 60 boys in a plane. And then we're taken to of course, it was a terrible journey because I remember we were all sick. There was bad weather and they were going up and down. There were four engine planes. Once we arrived, we were terribly sick from the journey. And it was freezing cold in the plane because we only had our clothes and we were flying during bad weather. And we were then taken to Windermere. And of course, the United Nations UNRWA operation in those days took charge of us, and the World Jewish Relief were also there. And in Windermere, there were wonderful things because they had huts where we had single rooms. It was like an army hut, and everybody had a single room, our own bed. At least the first time we had a blanket, and we had a feather bed, and it was changed, and we had a table, and we had a bath, and we had facilities, and we had a central an eating area with a kitchen. And of course, we were given trouble rations. And at that time, it was an organized, and because rationing was in Britain very, very relevant. So if you have three lots of bread, as it were, and as much butter as you can, of course, this was a time when I had. When my brother first met me, he asked me, "What have you got in your pocket?" And I said, "Well, I got some bread." I said, "Why don't they feed you?" I said, "Oh, yes, we had lovely breakfast, done that. But in case I'm hungry next week or the day after, whenever, say the food dries up and no food arrives, I can sustain myself with what I've got." You couldn't get over it, you see. That was a mentality that you've got to have provisions with you and on you so that they are safe, in order to make sure that you survive. And this is where my first impression of Windermere, I remember, when he arrived. I was there only a few days, and he came down. I explained it earlier on.
How about first meeting him, though? You know, you've explained how he asked about, you know, the happenings and how upset. It was a long time since you'd seen each other, wasn't it?
That's right. The first time, there was a hunt round the camp. There were about 350 of us. That two men in uniform, on a motorcycle, he and his commanding officer, I now know, are looking for Salek Fallinor. And I came out and I said, "Oh, I'm here." They said, "Well, they're there at the administration block." I went up there and there I've seen two men and I didn't really recognize him. And he didn't recognize me. And he said, "Well, he is Felix Fallinor," and introduced me to this commanding officer. He said, he left us, and then we went out for a walk. Of course, most of the 350 boys and girls, from that day, only knew me that I was the only person who got a life brother in uniform who was a pilot. And to this day, when they don't remember my name, when we have our reunions, he says, "This is the brother of the pilot who came to Windermere 50 years ago. And this is my my name to fame." But when we went out, he asked me very questions to find out if I'm the right one. Because when I left, I was little. And he was 13, and next time I was about 6 or 7 when he left, and then I was 16. So it is a vast difference. And he said to me, once he asked me various questions about mother, father, sister, to make sure that I am the brother, he turned around, he says, "Now he knows I'm the brother because he found a little black mouse black on my neck, which he remembers when I was a baby." And this was how he recognized that I am the rightful brother. So this is how we first met. But the stressful thing was that he was so terribly upset of hearing what happened to the family. And there was such a shock to me to see my brother so upset that I was very cautious discussing this with anybody else since, until now.
Must have been important for you, to have a living relative, and particularly a brother. Was that so, in a strange country?
Well, yes, it was. I think I explained it earlier on because I knew he was supposed to come here for an education. I was supposed to follow him for the 19, when I was sort of 13, 14. But of course it wasn't to be. But I was very pleased to see that he felt, instead of going in to university, and he was working for the family metal firm in Brighton, which was a protected industry. That means he need not have gone to any forces, A, because it was protected, and B, he was too young. But in 1942, he volunteered against my uncle's advice, and eventually ran away, volunteered, and joined the Air Force. Where he qualified in 46, in 42 and 46, during that 4 years as a pilot. And of course, with the war carried on another 3 months, he would become a pilot officer. He was on his way, but of course, he was then demoted in 46.
And during all that time, had he heard anything about his family, since the outbreak of the war?
He had no There was no, he says he's written them various times to the, through the Red Cross, but they were all returned. There was no communication with Warsaw from the day the war started. All the letters which were returned were because they say that the Warsaw area was completely secured, and they wouldn't even deliver in post, as far as he was concerned. But he has heard that there's a lot of trouble there, and the Germans were winning at that time between 1940 and 1941. They were going right across Europe mm-hmm. and Russia. So he said the only thing he felt he wanted to do is to do his bit, as it were. So he always liked the Air Force and planes. And this is where, and he was very good at it, and he passed with great honors as a pilot. I've seen the results since. And he sat for all his exams in Polish, in Canada, because he was a very clever boy. And he of course played bridge with his peers, and he taught me to play bridge soon after the war, and I taught my sons to play bridge, and they played for the college and for the university. My wife doesn't. She doesn't. She's not into bridge. And because of this, I don't play either, because I don't want her to be a bridge widow. But the boys play, even and their wives. So he was, of course, this was the time which, when we were living together, when he came back, after he was demobbed, we lived in Brighton, and we worked for the same family firm. And the firm, of course, was a very big metal processes. They were collecting metal from various engineering works, and we were shipping it from Shoreham Port to various steel works in the United Kingdom. And our job was to make sure that in those days we used to ship about 200 tons of metal a week from Shoreham. And it was very exciting to me because I liked boats and I liked the work. But of course, again, it was an exacting job, because when you deal with ships, you deal with weather, with tides, with unions, with labor, and for which I had to be trained. And this is when my uncle came in, and so I was trained into the shipping processing side, and continued with the firm.
But before you went into your training, though, you were saying, and it seems a long time ago, very early in the interview, that your education was continued in England, you know, first of all with the English language. And I think you mentioned boarding school. Could you tell me about that?
Yes. When I was in Windermere, once my brother brought me down to Brighton by train. And for the first time, I met two of my uncles and their families, who were my mother's brothers. And of course, I couldn't speak any other language. I couldn't speak English. And my first job was, according to my uncle, that I've got to go to a school to learn English. Now, I was then taken to a local port in Brighton, where I was for about 18 months.